BadQuaker.com podcast. My name is Ben Stone. Today is Tuesday, July 31st, 2012. As I've been doing recently, I want to give a quick free commercial for an upcoming event. And you're probably getting tired of hearing me say this if you're a regular listener, but it's quick, so I'll get right through it. Join the Raw Milk Freedom Riders and Lemonade Freedom Day for a picnic in celebration of our freedom of voluntary exchange for the foods of our choice. This is Saturday, August 18th, 2012, at noon, and it's happening 3rd Street Southwest between Maryland and Jefferson near the Capitol Reflecting Pool in Washington, D.C., or Mordor on the Potomac, as we like to call it. Now, this is important. It's important because if you don't fight for your freedoms on some level, really, what value is it? How can you? I'm not going to get into a thing about facing your ancestors and a lot of philosophical and or even religious stuff. I'm just going to say, you know, it's food. We have to be able to exchange food voluntarily among us. If you can get out there, bring a picnic lunch, join the celebration. If not, if you want to do something on your own, you can't make it to D.C. or you just, you know, but you want to make a statement, just set up a lemonade stand in your front yard. And, you know, even if you, if you feel that you really want to get active with this, have someone grab a camera and go with you and set up a lemonade stand in a public park. But, you know, like in all any act of civil disobedience, you need to be ready to pay the price if the goons in government decide to come down on you. Now, and that kind of takes us into today's topic. Finally, I'm playing the much anticipated interview with the Sovereign Citizen Jay from Porkfest 2012. Now, again, I've said this each time. I'm not a sovereign citizen, and I don't endorse their processes and however you classify what it is that they do. But I think it's important to at least hear him give his explanation for what he's doing, and realize that this is, you know, this has the potential of costing Jay dearly. This is not something that he is blindly going into. He knows what's on the line, and there's a lot. He has property, a horse farm. He has a lot to lose, and Jay is willing to stand on his principles and lay down everything that's important to him in order to hold to those principles. And even if you're like me and you don't agree with the sovereign citizens on a lot of stuff, It's still educational to understand where they're coming from. So for that reason, I did not interrupt Jay during the interview. I let him speak his piece, and I let him get out the things that were on his heart. So give him a listen. At the end of the interview with Jay, there's a bonus article called Breaking the Do Loop. And so without any further, I'll just jump right in and let you hear Jay from Porkfest 2012 and the interview that took place there.
Yeah.
Is this first year or many years? Or?
3 years I've been coming here.
Oh, yeah? Yep. Are you a New Hampshire resident or?
No, I'm not a resident anywhere.
Oh, yeah?
I'm a free man. Residents aren't free.
That's true. Are you part of the Free State Project?
Well, I am kind of part of the Free State Project. I'm actually, I kind of signed on to the Free State Project when it was first coming about. I don't know how long you've been paying attention to it, but my brother's Josh Noon.
Oh, yeah.
Josh Noon and the federal crime.
Mm-hmm.
So, but anyways, I live on Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
And I said on Massachusetts, not in Massachusetts. In Massachusetts would mean you're in the corporate body politic. I'm on the land, and you know, our language system has been so manipulated and perverted since the 1840s that, you know, it's been, they constantly manipulate and change the words around. So when people are speaking, you know, so many people call themselves a person. They don't even know what the word person means according to law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look up person in a law dictionary. Corporation, trustee. I mean, corporation, trust, or trustee in bankruptcy.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you study King James Bible, you see that God has no respect to persons, only living, breathing, you know, men and women, and that's what a lot of these guys who are Bible scholars in the Liberty Movement are, you know, kind of saying. I'm no Bible scholar, but I'm just kind of repeating what they say. But when you conduct yourself as a man or a woman, a free man or woman on the land, which I've been doing for several years now.
Mm-hmm.
I travel in my car, truck, no driver's license.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have many problems, although I've gotten arrested actually a couple times this year. But, well, it was because there was a warrant out for my arrest. And actually, not even a warrant out for me, a warrant out for my person, my property that I own,
mm-hmm.
which is a whole other story. But I have a lot of fun with this courtroom stuff. Anybody wants to YouTube Jay Noon, they'll see what I've done about my property tax. In fact, I got kicked out of my house last November. For not paying property taxes, and they basically the town went to land court, no trial, no jury, no due process of law, you know, no victim, no witnesses, and they just got a rubber stamp judgment from land court, which doesn't even have a signature on it, and then they had a an eviction hearing. I went to the eviction hearing. I had about 25 supporters at my eviction hearing, and I stated the town presents this judgment. Has no signature, no seals on it, that says, is saying that they own the property. And I stood up, but I wouldn't cross the bar, I wouldn't board that judge's vessel in a local district court there. And I basically said very assertively that they don't own the land, I'm the owner of that land. Mm-hmm. This judgment came from a corporation, it'd be like Walmart making a judgment, mm-hmm. and there's not even a signature, nor does this judgment bear any seals. And a judgment must bear 3 seals and 2 signatures, minimum. The seal of the court, the seal of the judge, and then the seal of the clerk magistrate who's witnessing the judge sign the order.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have 2 signatures and 2 seals. They don't have any of that stuff on these documents. So, and I didn't really understand that well when I was pursuing it a year ago. So, but what I've done, I mean 6 months ago. So what I've done is I put a land patent on my house. I just finalized a land patent this past Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
It's all recorded in the registry of deeds. And either next week or the week after, depending on how busy I am, I'm going and taking the boards off the doors and windows and moving back in. Well, I'm not going to be able to move back in right away. I'm sure I'll have no plumbing left. And, you know, Massachusetts winters aren't, you know, nobody was in the house all winter.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. We'll see what happens. But that's not even what I'm excited about. I'm excited about something else I've done. I took my certificate of live birth, got a certified copy of it, I brought it to the county recorder's office and said, I want to record this deed. Well, that's not a deed, that's a birth certificate. No, it's a deed. It's a deed to a landed estate, it's a deed to your body. And I want to record it as being the owner
mm-hmm.
of that landed estate.
Yeah.
And, well, we danced around for about 2 hours in the registry of deeds and telling me it can't be done, and I'm like, give me a lawful reason in writing why it can't be done.
Yeah.
And they couldn't come up with anything. They keep on passing me from one counter troll to the next counter troll to the next counter troll. And finally I got around to the assistant, whatever. And she's like, well, if you want to waste the $75 recording this, you can record it. It's our duty to record whatever. And I said, that's right. I go, if I want to record my footprint, I can do that, correct? She goes, you can record anything you want here. But, you know, it took me 2 hours to dance around with these guys, because that's what they do. They put so much red tape and bureaucracy in anything. Imagine that, trying to record a deed. You know?
Yeah.
And they tell me that my birth certificate's not a deed. And I says, well, go look it up in a law dictionary. What's the word deed mean? And I read the definition. If I tell it to you right now, I'm going to screw it up. But yeah. A deed is basically writing on paper that has a seal affixed to it. It's essentially what a deed is in Old English law.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just more to that definition than what I just told you. But so anyways, like that is a Black's Law Dictionary in that man's desk right there. I go, let's see what it says. Some guy that works in there. And I'm like, you want me to go open it? And the guy goes, that's my dictionary. You're not going to touch that. He says, no, I'm not going to touch your property if you don't want me to. I respect that. That's fine. He says, but this is, how come you're so afraid of the definition of the word deed? You know, just all these little details of these guys, you got to be able to hammer on them all the time. So anyways, then I did a notice of judgment, and I referenced a book and page number of that recorded certificate of live birth. And in notice of judgment, I proclaim that I, the living, breathing man, the son of God, Joseph Francis, who's actually but the name on the certificate of live birth is Joseph Francis Noon IV. So, but I, Joseph Francis IV of the family of Noon, claim, acknowledge, and accept the certificate of live birth as my property. So what you're doing when you do that is you're now removing yourself from being considered deceased to being in the living. Well, I just recorded that judgment. Actually, I got it right over there in my camper. If I just bring it over to you, you can read it maybe. So I recorded it just this past Tuesday, same day I did my acknowledgement. I recorded my acknowledgement of deed of my property, my land patent, and a notice to remove my patented land from the tax rolls, and then I record my notice of judgment that has, and they all have my seals and the seals of a notary on it, and then I go to the Superior Court, Clerk of Courts, in Hampden County, Mass., and I get their seal, authenticating the seal of the notary. So now I got two court seals, plus the king's seal. Well, who's the king? It's me. It's you. We're the kings. In fact, I'm going to do a rant Saturday night about that.
Yeah.
And so anyways, these documents have full faith and credit of the Constitution, or of the state and United States of America, because it's sealed by me, the king, and it's sealed by a notary and a Superior Court clerk. And they stand. And the thing is people don't understand about this stuff making things stand. You'll never see a signed, sealed, sworn to complaint in a traffic violation. Because they use color of law.
Yeah.
Most people don't even know what color of law means. And, you know, color of law essentially means it looks like law, but it's not law. You know, duck or color of duck. You know, it walks like a talk, walks like a duck, talks like a duck, but it ain't a duck.
There's a guy that podcasts on a similar topic. I'm trying to think of his name.
Ernest?
You're thinking of Ernest Hancock?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of, yeah.
No, Mark something. And I know this, I've listened to lots and lots of his podcasts. But he teaches people how to go right into court on let's say you're stopped for some stupid traffic thing.
Yeah.
And you have all the terminology, and he'll walk you all through the whole thing so that you can walk into court and you just lay the stuff down.
The guy from California, he's on the talk shows a lot. You're talking about Mark, he calls himself Ticket Slayer. Is that who the guy is?
No, I think that's a different guy.
And there's another guy named Mark Anthony something, who's a private attorney general.
Yeah.
Is that him?
No, but that's along the same lines.
Yeah. This is the greatest thing about this podcast. Can you imagine doing this 10 years ago, 25 years ago?
Yeah.
I mean, doing a podcast. I mean, is this streaming live or recording?
No, we're recording.
Okay, but it'll be downloaded when you're done, if you want.
Yeah.
And it's everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, we can stream live from our iPhones. The cops beating that was on the side of the road.
Yeah.
I don't know if you... Sorry about the swear there. But
we can take it out.
But anyways, so, you know, the whole idea is I'm going to explain in 3 minutes in a rant down here Saturday to these people about a criminal complaint that's issued by the king or a queen called Plea of the Crown. And according to Blackstones, and you know who Blackstones is?
Mm-hmm. Wrote the law book definitions and so forth.
Right. Blackstone's attorney... Commentaries on English Law is an authoritative book on American law.
Mm-hmm.
There's another guy named Lord Cope, who does also another set of books on that are authorities on American law. And I've been bringing up Blackstone's name to judges, and I have judges say to me, "Who's this Blackstone you're talking about?" I says, "Don't they teach you guys about that in law school?" And but you know, these judges, a lot of them know exactly what's going on. They understand you're dealing with the deceased. Mm-hmm. They understand that you have no rights until you you got to literally, like it says in some of Blackstone's writings, that every 5 years. And then Lord Cope says every 7 years or vice versa. But these guys kind of talk about the same things. That you got to basically go to the magistrate, go to your servants, and say, "Hey, listen, I'm alive." Mm. I mean, if King George wasn't seen or heard from for 7 years, his servants are going to think he's dead, mm-hmm. and they're going to take over and do whatever the hell they want. Mm. So that's what we the people got to do. And by taking the certificate of live birth and recording it in the county recorder's office, and then referencing the certificate of live birth in that notice of judgment, you are saying you're alive. In fact, my judgment says exactly that. I'm a living, breathing man. I am not dead. I am not from across the sea. You know, and I don't give any of these government corporations or governments or whoever they want to be call themselves permission to use my name, mm-hmm. or to use my property. So the fact is you know, you are considered deceased, and your certificate of live birth, that property's been bonded, mm-hmm. And they use it as surety to prop up their bond ratings. And then but nobody stands up and says they're alive. And I've been in this liberty movement. I'm 32 years old. I was born into it. You know, I never got a social security number. My father never got one. My youngest brothers don't have birth certificates. My two nephews without birth certificates. And I've just been learning about this Blackstone stuff in the past year. And it's just like, I'm pretty excited about it, because it's just, you know, By proclaiming you're alive through your judgment and registering the certificate of live birth, is how you get your house in order. And now we got to get our servants in order. There's a guy I listened to, I can't remember his name, a week ago. Might be John Stewart. You guys have probably heard him. Mm-hmm. But or it might have been on his podcast. Or his talk show. I call into a talk show probably 3 times a week, talk with people all over the country on them things. But anyways, and then I listen to him, download him, listen to him. But anyways, he had a great analogy. He said, basically what's happened is we're the captains of a ship. And you have a ship at sea. And what happens when the captain leaves the ship for, say, a weekend to go to town and check things out? Well, he's got a bunch of servants, a bunch of guys that work for him that maintain his ship and take care of things. Well, what happens when the captain leaves that ship and he isn't seen for 5 years or 50 years or 5 generations? Mm-hmm. Well, then you got a bunch of guys who basically become pirates and go out raping and pillaging all over the place because the captain isn't there to keep them in order. Well, what's been going on for generations is the kings haven't stepped up to say, "Hey, this is my court. This is my legislature. You do my bidding. You do my will. Or I'm going to have you charged for treason, yeah. or for misprison." It just hasn't happened. I mean, you know, the Blackstone's commentaries in English law, they don't even have them in the law libraries anymore. Mm-hmm. You got one law library in Massachusetts that actually supposedly has that book in it. The Supreme Judicial Court Law Library. How many people are going to go there and look at stuff? There's a law library in Worcester Superior Court, Hamden Superior Court, that I've been to. And I've gone and asked them librarians. And there was one old lady who said, "Oh, I remember taking Blackstones, and we had to ship them to Boston about 10 years ago.
Really?
I said, "What, did you run out of room in here?" She goes, "No, it's just very old and archaic law, and it doesn't really apply," she says. And this is, well, I go, of course it applies. This is where our laws derive from. So, it's, you know, we gotta, you know, when the 13 colonies, right after, shortly after the Revolutionary War, and even before the Revolutionary War, and as colonies were being settled, the two number one selling publications were the King James Bible and Blackstone's Commentaries on English Law. Mm. And pretty much every 14-year-old child had a better understanding of law in 1780s than a lawyer does today. And, you know, real law. But that's where our education system is controlled by, you know, one parasite in Washington, D.C. Mm. that, you know, is, you know, has his minion parasites all over, you know, doing its bidding. Maybe octopus is a better analogy, but I like to call these municipal corporations parasites.
Yeah.
And how much success are people in America having with this kind of activism?
In Virginia and Michigan, very good success. Uh-huh. And in fact, what they've been doing in Virginia, I mean in Michigan, is a guy got pulled over, and a cop ran his license plate, and he had just done recorded his certificate of live birth and notice of judgment, like a week before, and the cop said, "Oh, you're one of those untouchables. Have a good day." And if you want to actually, there's a guy who does a lot of he does Skype calls. His name's he goes by a moniker Rob Ryder. Mm. Have you heard of him yet?
No.
Just Google that term, Rob Ryder. He's got a website, something Rob Ryder Court of Record.wordpress.com. And he's got some great audios where these guys, and this guy Rob Ryder, he's a pretty smart guy. He's an engineer. He ran a nuclear power plant. He finally got out of that business, and he's worked on a couple of free energy or very inexpensive energy machines, and tried to bring them about and really got shut down big time. And so that's what kind of like woke him up into the whole liberty and freedom thing. Is
I was listening to Steve Howard like the past couple of days.
Yeah.
He's given a couple of talks on law. His experiences seem to be different from the ones you're describing, where there's people who try and go in with like a copy of Blackstone's and a copy of the Constitution and try and argue their rights and get thrown out.
Well, first off, okay. The Constitution is not my rights.
Okay.
The Constitution is a contract that a public servant agreed to. A Constitution is part of a contract that he has, that a public servant, when they take their oath of office, offers to the king. And the only way that contract becomes binding on that public servant is when one of us, we the people, one of the kings on the land, accepts his oath. So now when I deal with a cop or a judge, you want to see a judge's expression go totally blank, or you just like get blown away. Cops don't really care about this because they don't understand enough, but here's an excellent phrase everybody should learn and get confident with. I accept your oath. I bind you to it. I extend you my sovereign immunity while you carry out my lawful orders. And I remind you, you have a fiduciary obligation to me. You want to see a judge be silent for about 3 minutes? The first time I did that to a judge, my heart's pounded out of my chest, and I'm like, oh man, I never tried this stuff before. You know, but it takes courage to get to that point.
Yeah.
That was in March I did that.
Uh-huh.
And the judge had me put into custody.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he took me into custody. What I'm used to, that's usually happens when I go to court. They don't want to hear what I got to say. So, I come back out, and I say it to him all over again. Now the courtroom's only got the 7 or 8 people that came with me that day. And, He says, okay, and I don't remember exactly how things went. So, oh, how do you plead? And I says, well, I have my plea prepared right here in writing, this plea of the crown. That thing was like it had the plague on it. The bailiff wouldn't touch it, you know, they wouldn't have anything to do with my plea of the crown. So So I ended up mailing it to him. And the plea of the Crown is to investigate this officer who brought a charge against me. But that day in that courtroom, I had to figure I'd get ballsy. I'd try some stuff. So I asked the judge, I go, who's the victim? Oh, I don't know who the victim is. I said, well, who's the man that brings this charge against me? And the prosecutor standing over, he goes, I am. And I go, oh, who are you? He says, oh, I'm a so-and-so, the assistant district attorney. I says, oh, you're the prosecutor? He says, yes, I am. I says, how dare you bring a charge against your king? You're my servant. You work for me. And John, I don't want to hear any more. Another court date. So, I never even put my plea of the crown in yet, because actually, this is a case that I want to string along and try a bunch of stuff and get it right to a jury trial. It's really a slam dunk for me. But anyways, out of that particular case, they suspended the cop did an immediate threat, suspended my license or my right to drive, which I don't even have a license. So now I got two more other court cases going. I'm going to play around with this plea to crown stuff. And so I did a plea. I filed the plea of crown with the clerk of courts and gave one to the prosecutor. And I walked into the courtroom on suspended license charge. And I said to him,
"Hey Ben, nope. I'm going to shoot out because there's the Austrian economics panel.
Okay,
so maybe we could catch this up another time.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, appreciate that. No problem. Yeah.
So anyways, and that's picking me up good, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, your voice is perfect.
Good, that's a lot of people tell me these things. So anyways, I what I did in that court, I ended up filing a plea of the crown, of course, by certified mail. Mm-hmm. And then I Now, what I've noticed is when they call my name, since I've been doing some of this paperwork, they say, in the matter of Joseph Noon. And I stand up and say, oh, I have an interest in that case, in this matter. And what I say to them is, I tell them, I'm not at war with the state, I'm here in peace. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've been telling it to cops a lot lately. And actually, that really, you tell a cop on the side of the road, which I did last Tuesday, I got pulled over again. And I said to him, I said, hey, I want you to know I'm a man of peace, I'm here in peace, after talking to him for 4 or 5 minutes, and that just chilled that guy right out. It's like you gave him, you know, just he was relaxed to hear that.
Yeah.
Because a lot of these cops are really under the impression that these sovereign nation people that they're trained to believe are gonna,
yeah, they're gunners,
gonna pull out a, you know, an Uzi, right, and shoot them up or something.
Right.
So, and you know, they've just been brainwashed just like we have.
Yeah.
You know, they're just, well, they're overseers, the cops. So anyways, back to the court thing, the judge says, do you have a lawyer? I says, well, I says, my attorney's standing right there, and I point to the prosecutor. I says, I'm the king. And I says, and he's sworn oath to protect my rights, and I served him with a plea of the crown, certified mail a couple weeks ago, and he's my attorney. Well, she goes, what do you mean plea of the crown? I don't understand this. I says, well, if you open up the docket, it should be in there, because I also sent one in to the clerk of courts. So I said to the prosecutor, I said, did you get my my plea of the crown I served you? He was like, yep, I got it. He said, I said, did you read it? He says, yeah, about 10 times, and I still don't understand it. And I said, well, you know, you're going to have to open up a law dictionary, probably, and start dissecting that document. And I says, mm-hmm. So the judge goes, well, I can't read this unless you waive your right to counsel. And in Massachusetts, what they try to do is get you to waive a right to counsel or hire a lawyer.
Yeah.
So I said, well, what do you mean waive my right to counsel? She goes, well, there's a form you need to sign. I says, well, where's that form? So I look at the form. Oh, and before this, I accepted the judge's oath of office, binder to it. Did that spiel with her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was real good about that. She said, okay. She agreed to it, as far as I'm concerned. And anyways, I look at this document, and the document says, blank spot for a name, hereby waive my right to counsel, and it says more stuff. And I stop right there, and it says, do you mean you want me to waive my right to counsel? Is that what you're trying to coerce me into doing? And she says, yes, you have to waive your right to counsel, or I can't read this document. Then I said, we just went over your oath of office, and here you are trying to coerce me to waive one of my rights, which you sworn an oath to uphold and protect. And she's like, well, and she stumbled her words a little bit. And she's kind of a young lady. She was maybe, you know, in her early 40s. You don't see many judges that young.
Mm-hmm.
And she's certainly never come across anything like me before.
Yeah.
So anyways, I tell her, I said, this is a public document that has full faith and credit of the United States of America and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. I said, it's signed and sealed by the king,
mm-hmm.
and signed and sealed by two other kings. I had no notary signature on that. So she ends up, so I say, and you, I have extended you my sovereign immunity while you carry out my lawful orders,
mm-hmm.
and I request, and I wanted to say, and I order you, but I just said I request, I was very polite about it, you to take a few minutes of your time and read my plea of the crown.
Right.
So she reads it, and she's either a speed reader or just read part of it.
Yeah.
And flips through it. So she goes, I'm going to interpret this as a plea of not guilty and a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Well, kind of in a sense, it really is a motion to dismiss for a lack of jurisdiction,
mm-hmm.
if you were to translate it into their paperwork.
Yeah.
So I said, well, I says, ma'am, that's not the intent of that document. So the intent of that document is to bring a complaint against whoever the plaintiff is.
Mm-hmm.
And there appears to be no plaintiff. And she, so I said to her, so she goes, well, I'm going to have a motion hearing for July 23rd. So if anybody wants to come to Holyoke, Massachusetts District Court, July 23rd, 9 o'clock a.m., there's supposed to be a motion hearing on this.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to her, I said, well, who's the victim? And she looks at the prosecutor and says, she says, counsel or counselor, I can't remember how she put it. You have your victim here on July 23rd at 9 a.m. for this motion hearing. And he says, yes, Your Honor. and this is, the charges are no front license plate, refusing to give an officer a license upon request,
mm-hmm.
and driving with a suspended license. So, I can't wait to meet that victim. and the judge knew exactly what the charges are. So I imagine she might like to see who that victim is also. Now that's as far as I've got with my plea of the crown stuff. I'll be getting summons to court again because I just got pulled over for driving without a license the other day,
mm-hmm.
Tuesday. So, and all the suspension of license stems from this other frivolous charge, which I will clearly beat at a jury trial.
Yeah.
On a podcast, I'm not going to give up too much information
right.
about that.
Right.
But, another thing is I was told the other day it cost over $10,000 in Massachusetts for them to put on one day of jury trial.
Wow.
One day of jury trial. So, I know for every minute I'm in that courtroom, I'm costing them hundreds of dollars because they ain't collecting it from one of the sheep.
Right.
So I really make it a point to prolong this. I'll drag it out, and then when I'm all done, I got a handful of people that are looking to sign up looking to get me signed up to do a Title 42 suit.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm not sure I really want to even do a Title 42 suit, but I'm going to look into it and see what happens, for wrongful arrest.
Yeah.
But we got to discipline our servants.
Yeah.
And the king's been away, just like, I said, the captain has been away from his ship.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been paying attention to politics and religion.
Yeah.
And that's always what people say. Oh, don't talk about politics and religion. We've been brainwashed not to talk about this stuff. That's the most important things we can be discussing.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of things like Pork Fest here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we need to talk about politics every day.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it needs to be fresh in our minds. You know, that's how we got to keep our servants in line. You know, and with me, you know, my father has been always talking about politics ever since I was a young child, and I was always part of that conversation. So, you know, thankfully he was interested in talking about that stuff.
Yeah. Well, I got to wrap it up. I've got speaking thing in a little while. I got to get prepared for it, but I really appreciate the time that you took to share that with me.
That's why I came here.
I'm going to be probably about another week on here and on the road, and I don't know how long it'll take to edit each one of these, because I have a whole pile of them, but it should be at badquaker.com website, I would think within no sooner than like a week, week and a half.
All right.
And then I'm going to put them on one after the other each day, you know, in the weeks after that.
Good.
So sometime in there.
Good.
And if you want, like, give me an email address or something, I can drop you a note. I should stop the recording.
Folks, have you seen the silver and gold trading cards from Shire Silver? You have to check these out. They're specific weights of real silver or gold laminated inside trading cards, and they're a great way to show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. And now you can buy them using bitcoins or Federal Reserve notes. Folks, you really need to check this out. Go over to Shire Silver, watch the video on the main page, check out the list of merchants that accept silver and gold trading cards, and you can even learn how you can get paid to help spread the word about Shire Silver trading cards.
What does freedom mean? Tune in to LRN.FM to find out. LRN.FM is the Liberty Radio Network, a collection of live talk radio and podcasts, all coming from a principled pro-liberty perspective. LRN.FM show hosts aren't left, right, or conspiracy kooks. You can tune in 24/7 to LRN.FM via your phone, computer, satellite, and more. Listen free anytime at LRN.FM. That's LRN.FM.
BadQuaker.com audio article for Monday, July 25th, 2011, by Ben Stone. Breaking the Do Loop. I have a repeating thought. It's a question that pops into my head over and over every day. Each time I encounter one of the many failings of the state, I can't help but to ask myself, why do people continue to tolerate this? I know this is a common problem because I see someone asking this question on the internet almost every day. And the bad part for an anarchist is that the more we understand the true nature of the state, the more shortcomings we see, and the more we ask that question. It's a self-perpetuating do loop. I should explain what a do loop is. A do loop is used in computer programming where you want a program or hardware to continue doing something over and over until a specific condition changes. For example, security software that monitors motion in an empty room could tell a motion detector to send out a burst of microwaves. At that point, the if-then-else construct either repeats the loop or sounds an alarm according to the result of the construct. For example, 1. Send microwave burst. 2. Measure speed and quantity of burst echo. 3. Compare to last sample. If then else. If sample same as last sample, then go to 1. Else go to 4. 4. Sound alarm. In this example, the do loop would remain 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, etc., until something comes into the field of observation, in which case it would become 1, 2, 3, 4. One thing a computer programmer has to watch out for is a continuous do loop. Due to an oversight or error, a program can get stuck in a do loop with no way to get out. Not too many years ago, this was a common cause of the famous blue screen of death, which is becoming an endangered species with more advanced computers and better programming. An example of a social version of the continuous do loop is the Prisoner's Dilemma, or PD, of game theory developed by the RAND Corporation. The Prisoner's Dilemma goes like this. The police have two people in custody for a crime, but they lack evidence for conviction of that crime. The police separate the two and make each of them an offer. Rat out your buddy, and he will go to jail for a year and you will walk free. But if your buddy rats you out and you don't rat him out, he walks free and you get a year in jail. If you both rat each other out, you will both get 3 months. If you both stay silent, you will both be given 1 month on some trumped-up lesser charge. The prisoner's dilemma is used to justify the existence of the state because, the way the theory plays out, the prisoners will always cut a deal and will always serve the 3 months. They would be better to stay silent, but due to distrust and selfishness, they both always rat out their buddy. If you play it out over and over, the prisoners will always choose to rat out each other, which is always the worst choice. According to the theory, this is the great flaw in human nature that would cause humans to be in a constant condition of all against all, if not for the wonders of the state. The assumption being that without the state, people would always make harmful decisions based on distrust and the desire to get something at the expense of others. The state plays the part of an attorney who communicates to both prisoners, providing a safe go-between that assures both prisoners that they will get away with it if they cooperate with each other. The geniuses at the Rand Corporation believed the state interrupts the do-loop in society by providing an opportunity for people to trust each other. The problem with the prisoner's dilemma is that it was engineered by its designers to provide the results they were looking for to begin with. In a way, that's why the Rand Corporation exists, to justify governments and corporations and give them the answers they want to hear. You see, the prisoner's dilemma assumes that the nature of humans is to distrust each other and try to get something at the expense of someone else. And in the carefully designed status world of the prisoner's dilemma, they are mostly right. The state itself not only creates distrust between people, it also promotes the desire to get something at the expense of others. So when the folks at Rand designed the prisoner's dilemma, they did so not to discover the nature of humans, but to show how humans can be forced to behave in a predictable manner and be forced to depend on the state for their salvation. Consider the prisoner's dilemma from a liberty-oriented point of view. A tyrant kidnaps two people and accuses them of a crime without supporting evidence. They are forcibly separated and held incommunicado, threatened with jail, and offered a bribe for betraying their friend. The prisoner's dilemma causes the observer to assume guilt rather than assume innocence. Also, it completely leaves out human factors like friendship, devotion, and fear of long-term repercussions once the guy you ratted on gets out of jail and comes looking for you. So from a liberty point of view, it's not a prisoner's dilemma. It's a kidnap victim's dilemma. And finally, for the prisoner's dilemma to work, the prisoners cannot be following either the golden rule or the zero aggression principle, as either would prevent the kidnap victims from helping their kidnappers for the sole purpose of saving themselves. When open testing of the prisoner's dilemma took place, it was defeated by the tit-for-tat strategy, also called the equivalent retaliation strategy. The basic premise here is that in a real-life situation, the prisoners would know that if they rat out their friend, he will retaliate, and they plan on retaliating if their friend rats on them. So for this reason, they treat each other in the way that they would wish to be treated, and they refuse to rat out their friend, thus breaking the prisoner's dilemma do-loop. And every child knows and operates by the tit-for-tat strategy, since it's human nature and based on the same primal urges that drive the golden rule and the zero aggression principle. Actually, the tit-for-tat strategy is represented in the zero aggression principle through the law of property rights and the right to defend oneself and one's property violently if need be. Therefore, even within the status framework of the prisoner's dilemma, liberty prevails. The prisoner's dilemma scenario can only exist in a state-dominated situation, so it doesn't prove the need for the state. It shows that the only answer the state can ever offer is more dependence on the state.
And the defeat of the prisoner's dilemma with the tit-for-tat strategy shows that even when the state stacks the deck and controls the odds, the simple honesty of human nature and the power of the principles of liberty still overcome the lies, theft, and aggression of the state. So then, why do people continue tolerating this silly fixed game? I think Thomas Jefferson hit the nail on the head when he wrote the following. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light or transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, entices a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Jefferson was mostly right. His philosophic flaw was based on the fact that he failed to see the difference between a government and a state. We can throw off a government whenever we want, but the state will continue until humans see it for what it is. Once that happens, we won't have to throw it off. We will only have to stop supporting it, and it will tumble to the ground like a great brazen idol with no legs. End do loop. Go to Liberty. For more articles and podcasts on Liberty, the Zero Aggression Principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Badquaker.com audio article for Thursday, July 21st, 2011 by Ben Stone. Washington, D.C.'s War on Mexico. Frederick Bastiat, That Which Is Seen and That Which Is Not Seen. In the economy, an act, a habit, an institution, a law, gives birth not only to an effect, but a series of effects. Of these effects, the first only is immediate. It manifests itself simultaneously with its cause. It is seen. The others unfold in succession. They are not seen. Between a good and a bad economist, this constitutes the whole difference. The one takes account of the visible effect. The other takes account of both of the effects which are seen and also those which it is necessary to foresee. Now this difference is enormous, for it almost always happens that when the immediate consequence is favorable, the ultimate consequence is fatal. I was reading a story on a liberal website about how corn subsidies lower the market price on a variety of junk foods, therefore making them more cost-effective for poor people to purchase. The result being that the poorest people in the U.S. eat the most unhealthy foods, while the more affluent can afford healthy alternatives. Of course, the author, being a liberal statist, was only noticing one tiny suction cup of the massive tentacle of U.S. farm subsidies that distort the market and ruin people's lives around the world. But sadly, as I read his article, I couldn't help noticing the implied solution was to simply subsidize good food while bringing down the hammer of regulation on bad food. This tendency of willful ignorance and blind support of the expansion of the state is not unique to liberals. For every one liberal that I have struggled with, trying to show them that their state god is incapable of fixing the problems it creates, I have wrestled with 10 conservatives trying to show them that brute force and more laws will only grow the state and drive taxes and spending higher. If I could say it clearer than Bastiat, I would, but whether in his words or mine, the majority of the time, the sound of my voice is lost in the roar of the state's propaganda, driving the liberal towards more nanny regulations and driving the conservative to get tough. A typical hot button with a conservative is the illegal immigration issue. At the mere mention of the topic, the whole right wing explodes into rhythmic chants demanding tougher laws and brutal crackdowns. Speak of crime, gangs, or the drug problem, and the state's faithful congregation will leap to their feet in open praise of the stronger fist and the heavier boot. Sadly, the logic of cause and effect are swept to the side as emotions of nationalism take the pulpit. The fact that the state created the problem completely escapes the glare of the limelight as reason slips off the stage and out the side door. Corn is just the beginning. I wonder if the average reader of this article knows that because of U.S. corn subsidies, the price has fallen by two-thirds in the last 20 years. Generally, I'm all for lower prices, but when a government involves itself in a market so dramatically as to create such false prices, you can bet there will be huge repercussions in unimaginable places. But corn is just the beginning. The price of sugar is just as false, but manipulated in the opposite direction. And neither corn nor sugar can hold a light for the price manipulation that the rice market suffers. The reader may be wondering at this point why I'm bouncing from crime, gangs, drugs, and immigration to left-right politics and farm subsidies. Well, I'm not bouncing. They are all the same thing. Remember those faithful words of Bastiat about the seen and the unseen. The very reason governments should stay out of markets is because they are incapable of connecting the dots and seeing the association between their actions and the consequences of those actions. But I'm here for you, my reader, with a big black marker to show you how these dots connect. You see, the poor farmers of Mexico used to feed their families by growing three money-making crops: corn, rice, and sugar. Then the intellectuals in their ivy-covered universities decided that the standard of living in rural Mexico was too low, and the farmers needed to stop farming and move into Mexican cities where they can work in low-end manufacturing. So at the same time the U.S. ratcheted up its price manipulations with farm subsidies, NAFTA opened Mexico to a flood of corn that the farmers couldn't compete against. And yet, restrictions kept Mexican rice and sugar from flowing north. Imagine yourself a Mexican farmer, just getting by on a living you scratch from the ground in fields your family has tilled longer than there is memory to tell. Then the weak, corrupt government in Mexico City makes a deal with the strong, corrupt government in Washington, D.C., and your only source of livelihood is gone. The way your family has lived for centuries is taken away by people whose faces you have never seen and names you have never heard. That farmer has choices. One, starve and watch his children starve on the farm. Two, move to a dangerous slum in a Mexican city where the language is so different he almost can't communicate, and hope he can find work. Three, take a chance, sneak into the U.S. where work is available, and the cities are magic wonderlands compared to the Mexican slums. Four, grow something profitable. To fully understand point four, let me restate my accusation that the government in Mexico City is corrupt and weak. So corrupt and weak that it can't even provide security for those living in its cities, much less control the countryside. This is actually one of the great strengths of the Mexican culture. Once you get away from the government's influence and are submerged in the colorful freedom that rural Mexico affords, it's much easier to fall in love with the Mexican people and understand the depths of the tragedy that has befallen them. So in the past, a weak government was a good thing for rural Mexico. But since the U.S. war on drugs has driven so much wealth in the hands of crime lords, the weak government that used to technically exist in rural Mexico is gone, leaving the armies and private security of the drug lords. And they don't care about the price of corn. So the farmer that chooses to stay in his farm is told in terms he cannot misunderstand that his only path to security and prosperity is to grow the crop that the drug lord tells him to grow. Then, when the harvest is in, the sergeants of the drug lords pick villagers who take the risk and act as human mules carrying the drugs across the border while knowing that if they refuse or fail, their families will bear the punishment. Jumping back to point three above, you can see that the U.S. farm subsidies created a large segment of the illegal immigration problem. With a glance at point two above, you may notice that the increase in the labor pool in Mexican cities drove the local wages down and attracted U.S. manufacturers to move jobs out of U.S. cities and into Mexico, thus devastating whole neighborhoods in Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, and the list goes on. Now that I've removed the bandages that have hidden the wound that Washington, D.C. afflicted upon gentle villagers and farmers in Mexico, bear with me as I reveal yet more injustices. You see, some of those farmers who left their family land had to sell that land right at a time when there was a glut of Mexican farms available on the market. However, a buyer appeared, not a person, but an invention of the state. Multinational agribusiness swept in and gobbled up the choice farms at pennies on the dollar, driving even more Mexican farmers out of business. And if all of the above weren't enough, in the same time frame, 80 to 90% of the water of the Colorado River that used to go into Mexico was diverted, and the river no longer even comes close to reaching the sea, leaving whole towns in the delta abandoned. Of course, growing cities in the U.S. needed that water for important things like fountains and magic volcanoes and gondola rides in Las Vegas, and the expanses of golf courses in Scottsdale and Palm Springs. But don't think that water was all wasted on fun things the poor Mexicans can't even imagine exist. Have a drive into California's Imperial Valley, where old, leaky, broken canals carry that water from the Colorado River into alfalfa fields. And you'll see why it was necessary to dry up the river delta and force the Cocopah Indians off their ancestral lands. It's true that some of that water makes its way to Los Angeles and supports the residents. But those residents pay a 4,600% higher price than the agribusiness alfalfa growers. And what happens to all that alfalfa? The vast majority goes to the heavily subsidized U.S. dairy industry, where a USDA cartel markets its products with fixed prices and government-guaranteed purchases, eliminating its competition at the point of the state's gun. Let me recap this article just for kicks and giggles. Traditional Mexican farmers supported themselves by growing corn, rice, and sugarcane. The state has systematically manipulated the price and controlled the distribution of corn, rice, and sugar, practically eliminating the ability of Mexican farmers to continue their traditional lifestyle and making many of them slaves of the drug lords. The state's war on drugs has enriched drug lords, enabling them to become a virtual state in northern Mexico. NAFTA's attempt to enrich the lives of Mexican farmers, whether they wanted it or not, by driving them into the cities, resulted in both job losses in U.S. cities and an increase in illegal immigration into the U.S. With an increase flow of illegal immigration into ever poorer U.S. cities and richer, more powerful drug lords funneling drugs through the gangs into those cities, crime results. Multinational agribusiness not only absorbs massive amounts of tax dollars through direct subsidies and state price controls, it also expands itself by scooping up cheap land as family farmers are squished. Agribusiness, along with international gaming companies and city governments, along with their crony golf buddies, steal water from some of the poorest people in the Western Hemisphere so they can offer such niceties as artificially priced state-regulated gelato vodka smoothies to tourists who stare drunkenly at a fake pyramid
Oh, and we're supposed to believe this is capitalism. Having considered all of the above, I have to wonder, how long will it be before the wise overlords in Washington, D.C. decide the Mexican government has failed, and the U.S. military once again sweeps into Sonora and Chihuahua, and Marines once more march into the halls of Montezuma. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening.